Mona Hannah Atisha blew the lid off the Flint water crisis. She's the pediatrician who first documented elevated blood lead levels in children in Flint. And she's the author of the book, What the Eyes Don't See, the focus of our work all summer as we explored the crisis in Flint. On this episode of Created Equal, my conversation with Dr. Mona about her book and her work in Flint.
It was founded on the principle,
we hold these truths to be self-evident,
that all men are created equal.
That all men are created equal. Yeah.
4 years ago, we had an environmental crisis right here in Michigan, in the United States, that highlighted just how precious access to clean water is. When an emergency manager switched Flint's water source from the Detroit system to the Flint River, but failed to take proper precautions, the entire city of Flint was exposed to unsafe levels of lead. It was catastrophic, easily the most devastating public health crisis in recent memory. Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, a pediatrician in Flint, was among the first to notice elevated lead levels in Flint's children and to sound the alarm about the crisis. Since then, she's fought without hesitation or break to get officials to pay attention, to fix the water system, and to address the effects of the lead exposure. And she wrote a book about the crisis, What the Eyes Don't See, which details what happened in the city, as well as the intersection between so many different failures that produced the crisis. Dr. Mona, welcome to Detroit Today.
Stephen, it's always great to talk with you.
As I said in the open there, one of the things that is so poignant about this book and the way that you tell this story is that it takes in the intersection of so many things that failed: government accountability and transparency, incompetence, disinvestment, infrastructure, environment, advocacy, healthcare, all of them are in there. Talk about all the different issues that came together to create this huge, massive public health crisis.
Yeah, this book, you know, a lot of people ask me, like, you know, who are the culprits of this crisis? And they want me to, like, often name, like, villains that created this crisis. And it's a lot more complicated. It's a lot more nuanced because it is the intersections of all these different, often long-standing issues. It's the, you know, it's issues of capitalism and disinvestment and how, for example, General Motors left its birthplace and, you know, we lost so many jobs in Flint, and that disinvestment created unemployment and made things like poverty and violence endemic to the city of Flint. It's also about longstanding issues of racism in the city, from things like blockbusting and redlining that created a city center that was so disenfranchised and where many folks left the city, and with lack of regionalization made it unsustainable for the city to support its utility and, you know, for example, for water and other public infrastructure needs. So there's many, many longstanding causes that created the Flint water crisis. It wasn't one person and one decision, but it was almost a perfect storm of many issues from, like I said, disinvestment, racism, austerity, capitalism, a whole slew of issues that led to the decision to change that water source and then what happened.
And one of the really, I think, harrowing dynamics here as this unfolded was the fact that state officials initially said the water was safe, that it was fine, that despite what people were reporting in terms of reactions to the water that some people were having, funny smells, funny tastes, they were saying it's fine. And even you initially believed that the state was right. Talk us through that period about how you started to doubt what they were saying.
Yeah, and I think that really kind of gets at the title of my book, What the Eyes Don't See. Like, even I was blinded to what was going on. I didn't see anything differently, you know, in my patients, because lead is a silent pediatric epidemic. Kids don't present with, like, acute symptoms of lead poisoning. But it was kind of slowly, you know, disseminated through the system. But yeah, for a year and a half, the state was reassuring everybody that everything was fine. And you remember those pictures on TV, brown, discolored water coming out of people's taps. And for so many people, it was easy for us to say, oh, this can't be real. How can this be? see? Like, how can, like, brownish water be coming out of people's taps? Let's just choose to ignore this because it is about, you know, a different population far away. It's not me and it's not my kids, which is kind of the thrust of the story is that this was a city, this was a problem that people closed their eyes to, which also very much, you know, is a reference to the title. It's about people, places, and problems we choose not to see, not just in Flint, but everywhere, and how really it was our obligation to open our eyes and recognize that there was this injustice happening kind of right outside our back door. So it was, the issue was being dismissed despite so many red flags and really early red flags. And I think the most striking red flag is just a few months after the water switch. So the water switch was in April of 2014. By the fall of 2014, General Motors, which was born in Flint and still has plants in Flint, noticed that this water was corroding their engine parts. Mm. It's mind-boggling. This water was corroding engine parts, our drinking water, and General Motors was allowed to go back to Great Lakes water. Yet throughout this time, the people of Flint were literally told to relax, that everything was okay, that everything was in compliance, even though they knew that something was wrong with this water.
Yeah. Talk about the difference here for children in terms of this lead exposure, that the denial of about what was going on, of course, affected everybody's health in Flint, and the switch had affected everyone's health. And as I said, it exposed everybody in Flint to lead poisoning. Why is this different and so much more important when we're talking about young people?
Yeah, so, you know, the water issue, it was more than just a lead issue. So at first there was bacteria in the water, and we had boil advisories. And then because of all the bacteria, they added a lot of disinfectant, which is chlorine. Because of all the added chlorine, there were skin and eye issues. And then we had a buildup of a chlorine byproduct, something called total trihalomethanes, which is a carcinogen. It causes cancer. We had, I think, about 9 months of violations of that carcinogen. So lots of other issues, but throughout, once again, we were being reassured that everything was okay. And then that all changed, at least for me, and I stopped reassuring my patients that everything was okay, was when I heard about the possibility of lead in the water. When a pediatrician hears the word lead, it's a call to action. We know what lead does. It's probably the most well-studied poison known to man. We've known what lead has done really for centuries. It's potent, it's irreversible, and we worry about the children the most because it attacks a child's developing nervous system. It attacks the core of what it means to be you, and for kids it means it impacts cognition. It actually drops IQ levels. It can lead to things like developmental disorders, behavioral disorders. It's even been linked to things like criminality. And we now know through incredible science that it also impacts things like epigenetics, which can be passed on through generations, which is like the expression of your genes. So as more incredible research comes out, we now increasingly know that there is no safe level of lead. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the American Academy of Pediatrics, there is not any level of lead that's shown to be of any benefit, and our treatment really should be prevention. So we worry about the kids the most because that is when their brains are developing, and especially the younger children. But lead impacts everybody. Subsequent research done after my research also showed lead increases in adult populations, and as well as lead increases in animal populations. MSU's vet school came in because so many people were concerned about their pets and held animal clinics and also showed increases in the pets in Flint of lead levels. So it impacts everybody, but for kids, it's most detrimental.
Mm. I want to go back to September of 2015 and a press conference where you're talking about the findings that were beginning to trickle out about Flint's water. I want to play the clip and then have you talk about what you were feeling and thinking during this press conference.
This research is concerning. These results are concerning. And when our national guiding organizations tell us primary prevention is the most important thing and that lead poisoning is potentially irreversible, then we have to say something.
That was that initial sort of sounding of the alarm, I guess, about what was going on. Talk about what was going through your mind during that press conference.
Yeah, you know, I felt great at that press conference. I'm like, awesome, we are finally able to share this research with the public. Having that press conference was a bit of an academic no-no. When you do research as an academic or physician, it's supposed to go through the peer review process.
Right.
And that process takes time. It can take months. It could take up to a year. And I literally walked out of my clinic, and I stood up at a press conference with a growing team of supporters around me and shared this research, which really was not what you're supposed to do in academia. And I think one of the most incredible accolades I've gotten through this whole process was an award from MIT, which was a disobedience award, specifically for not going through that academic process. But that, our kids didn't have another day, and I wanted to scream these results. Like, once I knew these results, I wanted to scream them off a rooftop, you know, off the top of my hospital. I'm like, hey, there's something wrong here. We need to act. So I felt great at this press conference. I'm like, yes, I am doing my duty as a pediatrician. Like, I literally took an oath to protect children and to speak up for kids. And I was doing very much my professional, you know, and ethical and moral job as, you know, as a human being to stand up and protect children.
Yeah.
But that feeling of, yay, we're taking care of kids, and we're going to protect them, just lasted a short period, because, you know, within minutes, after that press conference, I began to be kind of denied and attacked.
Hmm. Talk about your relationship with state officials. That's kind of changed over times. For a while, it seemed like maybe they were embracing you, and other times, as you said, you were really at odds with them.
Yeah, you know, I think initially when this research came out, there was a period of being at odds, and the state was saying that my numbers didn't make sense, and that, you know, this, they didn't add up to their numbers, and they were very much kind of dismissing and denying these facts, just as they had done with anybody else who throughout this whole process had raised concerns. The amazing moms, the activists, the journalists, the water scientists, you know, for a year and a half, anybody who had raised concerns about this water issue was being denied and dismissed. However, you know, after this press conference, and I think there was an incredible role of you guys, of the media, and of amazing journalists who caught on to the story, then the tide began to turn, and eventually, kind of with our persistence and with kind of fighting back, and with teamwork and with more science, the state eventually conceded and admitted that, yes, you know, there is a crisis. And within weeks of that press conference, we went back to Great Lakes treated water, and obviously since then have been working on our recovery. So, you know, my work, my relationship with state and federal officials has always been that of a partner. One of my favorite lines, so I grew up, my brother was this kind of Star Trek nut, and I grew up kind of being forced to watch a lot of Star Trek. And there's a line that I love from Dr. McCoy, who says, you know, damn it, Jim, like, I'm not a prosecutor, I'm a doctor. And I think of that line all the time in my head, like, I am not a prosecutor, I am a doctor. And my constituents is the children of Flint, and I will work with whomever from whatever political party to get whatever I need for not only Flint kids, but as many kids and, you know, the whole entire city as possible. So that has been kind of my attitude going in. So in many trips to D.C., in many trips to the Capitol Hill, you know, I'm working with whomever, both sides of the aisle, because you have to share the story of Flint and to really share kind of what Flint needs, especially in the long term.
I grew up in the 70s when we still had lead and gasoline for a while and in paint. Why was this worse?
There's actually an entire chapter in my book that goes into lead history. We used to have a lot more lead in our environment, and it was a really evil corporate-driven, profit-driven industry that put lead, really forced the use of lead in gasoline and in paint and in plumbing, largely to make a profit. There's a whole kind of section in there of General Motors and Kettering, who put lead in gasoline, tetraethyl lead, because they had a patent on it, even when they knew it was dangerous. So in the 1960s, 1970s, we did have a lot more lead in our environment. And we used to think that it was safe. Those higher levels were safe. We've learned a lot since then. We have great policies that have restricted the use of lead and paint and gasoline. And for the last few decades, those levels have been coming down. So yes, people do have less lead exposure now than they did 20, 30 years ago. However, at that same time, we have also learned that there is no safe level of lead, that levels that we did think were okay decades ago when children were, for example, coming to our ERs, our emergency rooms, with acute intoxications and they were seizing and comatose and they needed acute chelation. We don't see that as much anymore because those levels have been coming down so much. But at the same time, we've also learned that there is no safe level of lead, that we should practice this thing called primary prevention, where children are never supposed to be exposed to lead. So another thing that's nuanced in this whole story is that, yes, children's lead levels increased in Flint, but my research, my work never should have been necessary. We should not be measuring the scope of this crisis by children's lead levels. If we are truly to practice that thing called primary prevention, when we detect lead in our environment, that should be the full stop. That's when we should be taking action. We should never be using children as the literal detectors of environmental contamination. And our lead in water levels were astronomical. They were in the hundreds and thousands of parts per billion. There was one home I remember in Flint with a lead level of 22,000 parts per billion. And kind of as a reference, the EPA, recognizing there's no safe level of lead, has set something called a maximum contaminant level goal of zero parts per billion. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends one part per billion for child care facilities and schools. So the focus really needs to be on what's in our environment, not what's in our children. When we test lead in the blood of children, it's often too late. It has a short detection window. And our screening programs, which I based my research on, were designed to detect lead in household sources, not in water. So it's also a different age of exposure. So there's a lot of nuances to the story. But nobody's saying that Flint has the worst lead levels in the country. There are zip codes in Detroit, I was in Cleveland last week, Philadelphia, Baltimore, that have higher rates of lead exposure. And it does not mean that what happened in Flint wasn't an injustice. What happened in Flint was a man-made policy decision. We were literally poisoned by policy, and because of that, it warrants all.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
All this attention.
And Dr. Mona, I want to talk a little about the 2016 State of the State Address, where you were in the audience. And this was the first time that Governor Rick Snyder gave any sort of real attention publicly from him to the full effects of the water crisis. Let's listen to a clip of his speech that night, and I want to get you to tell us what was going through your mind as he was saying this.
To begin, I'd like to address the people of Flint. Your families face a crisis you did not create and could not have prevented. I want to speak directly, honestly, and sincerely to let you know we are praying for you, we are working hard for you, and we are absolutely committed to taking the right steps to effectively solve this crisis. To you, the people of Flint, I say tonight, as I have before, I am sorry and I will fix it. No citizen of this great state should endure this kind of catastrophe. Government failed you, federal, state, and local leaders, by breaking the trust you placed in us. I'm sorry, most of all, that I let you down. You deserve better. You deserve accountability. You deserve to know that the buck stops here with me. Most of all, you deserve to know the truth, and I have a responsibility to tell the truth. The truth about what we've done, and what we'll do to overcome this challenge.
I always think of that moment as one of the most emotional moments I ever saw for Governor Rick Snyder, who we, of course, got to know pretty well over the 8 years that he was in office as a pretty stoic guy. I wonder, Dr. Mona, as you were sitting there at that moment, watching him talk about this, what were you thinking?
Yeah, you know, it was a surreal moment. I never expected that the state would concede, that they would admit their error and pledge to, you know, work on the recovery. The only perspective I had in this crisis was the Washington, D.C. lead and water crisis, which was over a decade ago, and nobody ever there admitted error. Nobody was held accountable, and it lasted for years, and there was multiple cover-ups. So when I started this work and did this research and publicly shared it and, you know, was denied, I expected a years-long battle to expose the truth and get what Flint kids need. So to hear the governor very emotionally, very publicly admit error and pledge to fight for its recovery was surreal and nothing that I would have expected.
Hmm. Today, when you think about the promises he made at that moment, I will fix it. We will do everything to overcome this challenge. Do you feel like the state has met that obligation?
I think it's in process. It's long-term work, and that was one of the hardest parts about writing this book, because the story is nowhere near over. I'm in Flint right now, and we're still on filtered and bottled water mm-hmm. as our pipes are being replaced. But hey, our pipes are going to be replaced this year, and that's amazing. And we'll be the only third city in the country that has replaced their lead pipes. And now, because of Flint, many more cities are following, and because of Michigan's new lead and copper rule, you know, the entire state will replace all their lead pipes in the next 20 years. In terms of what we need for the long-term recovery of children, we're getting there. It's nowhere near complete. We need long-term investments, for example, in early childhood and home visiting and school health resources and nutrition support and healthcare support. And that has not been guaranteed for the long term.
So I want to talk a little about what we heard from Attorney General Dana Nessel recently when she said she was going to have to drop all of the charges against officials in the Flint water case. But she also said that she may have to refile charges against the people who are involved and that they are conducting a new investigation. What was your reaction to that news?
So I think, like most folks, when you saw those initial headlines, my mouth just dropped. Like, charges are being dropped. You know, are you kidding me? This has already been a drawn-out process of accountability. It's been already going on for over 3 years. But then I think when you kind of read the articles and dig deeper, it may be for a good reason. So it sounds like millions of documents were not uncovered. Many devices were never uncovered as well. And that the new team, the new Solicitor General, kind of feels like they need to start over to make this investigation as thorough and as comprehensive as possible. So I hope that is the case. There's actually a whole chapter in my book called Truth and Reconciliation. Accountability and justice is critical for healing. So as a physician, as somebody who's in Flint every day, working with Flint families, justice is probably one of the most important prescriptions that can be prescribed for families here. Justice needs to be served. Mm. And I hope, like the Attorney General said, you know, justice delayed is not justice denied.
Yeah. Also, I want to get you to react to her accusations against former AG Bill Schuette. She says he handled this so badly that she had to do it this way and that it was sort of soaked in politics the way he approached this. Was that your impression of the way the investigation had been conducted before?
I can't really comment. I don't really kind of have a firsthand impression of how it went. I was subpoenaed a few times, but I don't know the details of those investigations. Once again, I'm a doctor, not a prosecutor.
Right. In the last few years, we have seen huge regulatory rollbacks and holes in staffing at the EPA, which, of course, oversees clean water in this country. Mm-hmm. What's your sense of whether that might be inviting more Flint, not just here in Michigan, but across the country?
Absolutely. And I think that's why the story of Flint and why this book is so resonant today, because it really speaks to the deeper crises that are happening in our nation. And one of those is this disrespect for science, the disrespect for facts. I mean, common sense science was denied in Flint. And I love to share the story. There was a Flint area fourth grade classroom who conducted the experiments on the corrosion regarding the water. So they took Flint water and they took Detroit water and they tested it. And these fourth graders also saw that there was this difference in corrosion control. And these are experiments, for example, the state said was too expensive that they couldn't conduct. It was too difficult to do. But fourth graders did it. So here, you know, let Flint serve as this kind of, you know, egregious example of what happens when we disrespect science but also of the power that science and scientists hold and a greater community to speak truth to power. So we're seeing that nationally, not only kind of with our denial of things like climate change and vaccines, but also in these regulations. That if we learn anything from the Flint story is that we need stronger regulations. We need a stronger lead and copper rule. We need a stronger Safe Drinking Water Act, especially kind of if we respect history, and there's a lot of history in this book too. We just celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Cuyahoga River fire in Cleveland, which was really the impetus for the Clean Water Act. I mean, we have to, we've come a long way. You know, rivers aren't catching on fire as much. Flint River actually has a history of catching on fire twice as well. But we have to kind of follow the science and do what's best to protect public health. And we're not there yet. But awesome and really creative innovations are being seen at the state level and at local levels because of federal inaction.
Yeah. If you think of the trouble that we're having even this summer, I keep seeing pictures that people are posting on social media of PFAS showing up in places where they go to the beach and swim. I mean, your point about how critical this issue is now, just at the time that we see this tremendous pushback against science and defunding of the mechanisms that would keep us safe, it really is kind of frightening.
There's quite a bit about this in my book, and I talk about the history, for example, of how lead got into gasoline. And one of General Motors' kind of industry apologists was this guy named Robert Kehoe, who said that if you can prove that tetraethyl lead is dangerous, we'll take it out. And that sets forth something called the Kehoe paradigm, which over a century ago has really governed how we practice in terms of public health and really in terms of regulations, that something is safe until proven dangerous. And that's exactly opposite of common sense, prevention, the precautionary principle, which is how we're governed in medicine, by the concept that something should be dangerous until proven safe. And because of this philosophy that was set a century ago, it has persisted, and it has led to this industry-driven and profit-driven mechanism where, you know, we have tons of chemicals out there in our environment that are not regulated, and it's really been kind of at the upper hand of industry. And we've also poorly held industry accountable for what they've done, and I think the PFAS disaster is another example.
Going back to that initial press conference again from September of 2015, and you talk about what the state and people in the city of Flint need to do to start moving in the right direction and keep themselves safe. Let's listen to a small clip from that.
For high-risk groups, especially those infants who are on the formula and the pregnant moms, we would say no tap water. Lead-clearing filters are a good idea. More public education is needed. And then we would advocate for a connection to a Lake Huron water source.
Do you feel like those recommendations were heeded by people after you said that?
Pretty much. I think you can check off almost every single one of them.
We got that right.
So Senator Stabenow helped us get pre-made formula for all our babies on WIC. So babies didn't have to mix powdered formula with water, or it already came pre-mixed. Lead-clearing filters were distributed, and once we became a federal emergency, that got distributed even better. We, within weeks, went back to Great Lakes water. So there's always room for more education, even to this day, but by and large, those immediate steps were taken.
I wonder what you think will have to be done to restore trust in state and local leaders, the trust that really got broken during this water crisis. What else do you think needs to be done to make people in Flint or in the whole state really believe that leaders have their best interests in mind?
Yeah, and you know, with Flint, that trust wasn't lost just in our water crisis.
Of course
not. It was lost probably before, because Flint for years has suffered from disinvestment and cuts in revenue sharing and population loss and all these other policies, defunding of our schools that have really left this city in that near bankrupt state that then forced it to be taken over by the state. So that rebuilding of trust is going to take a long-term commitment to the people of Flint and in the city's full recovery. So I think that's, it's long-term work. It requires a continuation. It's not just about replacing our lead pipes, but it's also about, making sure that kids and families have everything else they need to be healthy and successful. And that's from schools to healthcare services to safe communities. It's, adequate policing and what have you. Criminal justice is a long list of things that need to happen. And what's interesting, this trust question comes up a lot. I was speaking with a group of philosophers, and this issue of trust came up, and somebody so beautifully said, well, don't you think it's important to always have a healthy dose of mistrust? And I think they're absolutely right. I think part of the problem in Flint was a lot of us were maybe too trusting, and we believed that everything the state and the federal government was saying, that the water was fine. I think it's really important for all of us to remain curious, to keep our eyes open, to ask questions, and maybe to have just a tiny healthy dose of mistrust.
Right. We in the media, of course, are very familiar with that healthy dose of mistrust.
Yep.
I also wonder what you make of the time that's lapsed between the crisis and now, and whether we've lost focus over that time. I mean, that's always a fear, I think, is that the crisis gets everybody energized to meet the challenge, but over time, everyone kind of gravitates to other issues or just forgets. Are we forgetting about Flint?
I think it's natural. There's crazy things happening in the news that warrant our attention, and that's totally understandable. But I think the neat thing that's happened is the incredible power of what Flint has done to the state and national landscape. So, for example, my next phone call is with Newark, New Jersey, who has a lead and water crisis right now. The last action level for their city was like 67 parts per billion, and they're passing out filters. And what's been really neat is that it's really open people's eyes nationally to issues not only of drinking water issues, but also lead issues, infrastructure, environmental justice issues, children's health issues. So although kind of our acute crisis may have faded from the national news, our impact and really kind of the multiplicative impact of this crisis is far-reaching.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, it is always really great to talk with you. Thanks very much for joining us. On the next episode of Created Equal, we'll hear from the congressman who experienced the Flint water crisis as both a lawmaker and a resident.
This Flint story is not just a Flint water story. This is a story of a community that has been left behind in a lot of different ways. And water was just one, really significant piece of that story.
Created Equal is a production of WDET, Detroit's NPR station. Our executive producer is Joan Cherry Isabella. Our producers are Elena Frugier, Jake Neer, and Anna Marie Seisling. Our sound engineers are Matt Trevethan, Rowan Niamisto, and Rasan Cherry. Senior editor and musical composer is Sam Bobian. Our digital and social media team is Maida Stange, Shiraz Ahmed, and Tony Brown. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson.